不要输了等你的不要输了等你的来嘛来嘛哎来哎来哎来哎不要输了等你的红下哎。
Welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies on iTunes and via the web. I'm your host, Nick Cheeseman, a fellow at the Australian National University's College of Asia and the Pacific. Today I'm joined on the sidelines of the biennial Asian Studies Association of Australia conference by Simon Creek, a lecturer in Southeast Asian History at the University of Melbourne, to talk about his new monograph, Embodied Nation, Sport, Masculinity, and The Making of Modern Laos, published in 2015 by the University of Hawaii Press. Simon, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot, Nick.
Can you give us the backstory to the book? How did you end up writing a book about sport in Laos?
Well, it's a very good question. It goes back to my PhD dissertation, which I did here at ANU, and developing a topic for that dissertation. I was very eager, having spent the last few years before that, some years before that, living in Laos, to write a history of development, sort of an intellectual history of development, which in the language that I now possess, but probably didn't possess then, you know, issues around, you know, modernity and progress and these sorts of things. And that was simply as a result of having lived in Laos. When was this? Sort of early in the 2000s, and this sort of area of development and development work, development projects, and this kind of thing were just ubiquitous in the country. So I sort of arrived at ANU with this in mind, but I also had a background in history, and specifically history of sport. I'd written a master's thesis at Melbourne Uni some years before that on the history of basketball in Victoria. So I had some sort of knowledge of that field as well. It was actually my supervisor, Craig Reynolds, who suggested putting these two themes together and sort of focusing the study on development, if you like, a little more so by focusing specifically on sport and physical culture. So in a sense, it sort of brought together two different strands in my own experience. And I suppose as the project proceeded, I must say at first I wasn't too sure about it. Sport sort of has this side to it where people don't necessarily take it all that seriously in academia. And I had to be convinced, I suppose, that doing something like this was a great idea because no one had done it before, on Southeast Asia at least, not in spite of that fact. And as I sort of proceeded through the project and realized how I could do that kind of cultural and intellectual study that I was interested in doing through the motif of sport, and through the motif of the body, I became very excited about it and was able to explore exactly those issues which I had been interested in to start with.
You just mentioned the motif of the body. On page 10 of the book, one statement struck me, sprung out at me. You have a theoretical paradox of sorts that while the physical realm is commonly conceived as the obverse of the cognitive, the concern with physicality is necessarily expressed through linguistic and cultural representation. Can you explain what you mean by that and why it matters for a study of sport?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, and it goes right to the heart of the approach. It's basically this sort of recognition that while studying the body and being interested in the way in which the body is imbued with meaning in this particular social, cultural, and historical context, the main way, not the only way, but the main way that we can address that issue and that question is through language. So it sort of flips that question around language and the body sort of upside down in a sense, that we can't simply observe the body in isolation from language, and that sort of the meaning is communicated in the ways that the body is spoken about and discussed. And this is particularly important for Southeast Asian history, for any history, I suppose, when you're working across language and you become so sensitive and so attuned to the importance of language that in a sense it doesn't really matter what you're studying, language is going to be very important for what you're doing. And in a sense, it's just applying that that logic to the body and that recognition that although we're discussing something that's physical and material, that the linguistic is going to be of fundamental importance.
You indicated already that you had an interest in Laos, and then you brought that interest together with a prior research interest that you'd had in sport. It seems like there's still some effort on your part to justify that interest with regards to the particular case study, because on page 3 of the book you say, Laos may seem an unlikely place to study the history of sport and related aspects of physical culture. You point out that it joined the Olympic movement very late in 79, has never even come close to winning a medal, and that there's a general perception that people in that country are not sportsman-like or sportswoman-like, although actually sportsman-like is a more appropriate term for this book. So can you say a little bit more about then how you justified this particular research interest in this particular case study? I mean, presumably you could have gone to Thailand or Indonesia, countries which do have some sporting record on the international stage, and yet you stuck with Laos.
Yeah, look, I mean, I could have gone to those countries. Obviously, I went to Laos because that was the country I was interested in and had learned the language for and things, and I could have done this study in any country, really, and perhaps one day I'll do it on Australia. I mean, I think a study of Australia in a similar way would be very interesting. But I think I sort of say at the end of the book that Laos is interesting in this way in particular, precisely because you don't associate it with success in sport. So there's this sense that, you know, powerful countries in world sports such as Australia or the United States, I mean, it seems fairly obvious that sport would be something to study in these particular contexts. In sort of medium-sized countries, if that's what you want to call Thailand and Indonesia in sporting terms at least, there may be some interest. These countries do win the occasional Olympic medal and sends the country mad and so on. But what I'm really interested in is the fact that this significance is just as great in a country where none of these things exist. I think it shows just how ubiquitous some of these ideas are. I mean, of course, the whole book in a sense is about the ways in which these ideas have developed historically in the case of Laos through the particular history of Laos through the 20th century and the various different political regimes and social and cultural influences that have been experienced there. But you're right. I mean, you could apply this country, this study, or this approach to other countries, come up with a slightly different approach. But Laos is interesting precisely because it shows just how ubiquitous these ideas are if they are, you know, coming up in these very interesting and profound ways in a country where no one would ever expect them to be.
Before we turn to the contents of specific chapters, one other key term that I'd like to signal and ask you about, and that's masculinity. So masculinity is in the subtitle of the book, and it's manifest throughout the contents of the book. Practically every image has masculine images of physicality, of physical education. The cover of the book shows a line of young men marching shirtless out of a physical education institute. What's the place of gender in the story you tell, and why concentrate on men in sport?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that as well. And again, it sort of connects sort of the intellectual interests as well as my own personal interests in some ways. Look, I think when you study sport, the first thing you notice, or perhaps some people don't notice, and perhaps this has been the problem in the past, it's just so obvious and so evident that you don't notice it. But, you know, with a sort of, if you have antennae sort of attuned to gender and these sorts of things, the first thing you notice about sport is just how dominated by men it is. And it's not to say that only men take part in sport, and I make the point very clearly in the book that as in many countries, Lao women have done better than men in international competition. So it's not that women don't play sport. It's around how sport creates certain representations of the body, which are often, in fact, overwhelmingly images of the male body. So although women are, and this again is something that you'll observe in most societies in slightly different ways perhaps, although women are certainly playing sport, it's often considered to be, perhaps not considered to be, but is often the images of men which dominate in coverage and how it's understood. So around themes and motifs of strength, of muscles, and these sorts of things are valorized as masculine qualities and not necessarily as feminine qualities. And for that reason, there's different sorts of games and sports that men and women play. I mean, and this also is observable in different societies. So there's that aspect. I mean, sitting down and deciding to do this topic and realizing that most of the people I was reading about in the sources, most of the pictures I was looking at, were men, and taking account of this and asking from the outset what this might mean for the study. The second aspect of that, which sort of linked in very nicely with that in a sense, was my own background as a sportsman, I suppose, playing football, Australian rules football, as a kid, as a teenager, and as a young adult. And particularly, I suppose, when I started playing football as an adult in my early 20s, it's probably around the time that I was doing my master's on basketball, and becoming very aware of just how sort of masculine and sort of hyper-masculine a football club could be. And I suppose I couldn't get that image out of my mind. I mean, it didn't really figure in my earlier research. It didn't perhaps need to. It wasn't really as relevant. But I found that I couldn't really get these images and these ideas out of my mind as I was doing the study. And, of course, we're talking about a different national context. But I found that when I was doing the research in Laos, and I sort of joined a group of guys who was playing soccer, football, through that time to, kind of as a research thing, but also as a social thing to meet different people and so on. And I found that all these sort of images from my experience playing football in Australia were equally true, perhaps even more so in this environment in Laos. So sort of putting all those things together, it was just clear from quite early on that men and masculinity were going to be a big part of this study.
Well, the first chapter of the book doesn't begin with football. Rather, it begins with an indigenous sport. You go back to the colonial period before coming forward, tracing it step by step up to the present day. Can you explain why you chose this sport to begin your topic, to begin the book, and talk us through some of the different periods in which this sport features in a political and cultural discussion around what it means to be Laotian?
Sure. There's a story behind this as well, funnily enough. The sport you're referring to is tiki, which literally means hit ball. The ball is called ki, and the word for hit is di. So it's a sort of traditional hockey game. Probably when I set out to write this chapter, I wanted to write a chapter to begin the book on indigenous games, in recognition that Western sports, as they're known in Laos by the name, the word gila, were not the earliest or original form of physical activity or physical games, to demonstrate that these arrived into a context in which there were already things that looked like sport or some kind of physical competition. So I wanted to look at some, have a chapter on these and to sort of try and understand how one set of practices, indigenous practices, in a sense perhaps evolved into what we might understand to be modern sport. And I found quite early on as I was doing this that this was a fairly naive approach, I suppose, and that what I realized when I was looking at this game, Diki in particular, was that it was very hard to do justice to this sort of idea that I had of sort of moving from a traditional to a modern sort of paradigm, in the sense that the accounts of Diki themselves were created out of the colonial encounter and were themselves a product of that sort of modernizing impulse that came with colonialism. So I suppose as I sort of rethought this, it became, instead of being a study of tiki itself and whether this was a traditional game or or a modern sport or that kind of question, which is an interesting question in sports studies and kind of a perennial question. It sort of shifted from that question to more one of how is Dickey being understood over time, and how does that fit with how we understand modern sports to be, or how modern sports are understood in the case of Laos. And as I did that, it was a good sport to do this with, or a good practice to do this with, because a number of anthropologists, a number of French travellers, Laos scholars as well, had sort of turned their attention to Dickey at various stages throughout the 20th century. So that sort of became the source material, and the question became the epistemological question of how that was understood, and how in that way Dickey can be understood within the broader context of an emerging sort of proto-national identity, if you like, within Laos.
Why were those administrator ethnographers interested in this game? I mean, what drew them to it?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it was tied very intimately to the history of a very famous and important Buddhist pagoda in Vientiane, in the capital city, Tatluang, which is the great stupa. This is the national symbol, the most important stupa or pagoda in the country, and had already emerged sort of in the colonial period as kind of a national symbol. So this game was sort of had been played at Tatluang for very different reasons in the past, but I think this drew people's attention to it, to ethnographers in particular, French ethnographers, around the turn of the century. And one of them, in particular, Alfred Raquet, had sort of produced this wonderful account of an actual game that was played. I think it was 1902, from memory, or perhaps 1900. And, you know, it sort of created both of these ethnographers or travellers, really, created this image of Dickey as a national game. And I suppose what drew me to these accounts was the way that even in 1900, these Frenchmen were able to sort of think about this idea of Dickey as a national game in this kind of modern framework, if you like, a modern proto-nationalist framework in which this sort of cultural relic from the past could reflect some sort of continuity with the grandeur of Laotian kingdoms of the past. Now, if that was all, then probably wouldn't have been worth a chapter or an extended analysis. But what happened after that is that different people through different periods, through the 30s and then through the 40s and into the 50s, approached Dickey in roughly similar ways. I mean, but there's very different sorts of people, they're very different sorts of scholars. In the 1930s, there was Nui Apai, who was a Lao teacher and scholar who had trained in France, and sort of a budding scholar among a small number who sort of came back to sort of document the Lao past. And he also wrote about the Tatluang Festival, the big festival, Bun Tatluang, which takes place at Tatluang every year. And in that context, he also wrote about Dickey, but he wrote about it in quite a different way. He was building it up as this sort of Lao tradition, but he also wrote about it in a way that really emphasised the manhood, the masculinity of the players. He talked about the muscles, he talked about their strength, he talked about their aggression, which sort of introduced this new aspect to accounts of the game. And then moving into the 1940s, famous French anthropologists who worked on Laos started to discuss the game, beginning with Paul Lévy in 1942. He published the research in 1952, a very detailed ethnographic account of the game. And then Charles Archambault, the wonderful, well, sort of unrivaled, unparalleled documenter of Lao ritual and tradition through the 1950s, also wrote about it, but in broader terms, not just in Bianchan, but in different parts of the country. And without going into every detail, you can sort of chart the development of this sort of national narrative through this game, something that's uniquely Lao, which by the end of this period in the 1950s, Lao had actually become a country and a nation, independent nation. Although for most of this period, it had been a colony. So I suppose to go back to that original point, rather than sort of locating tradition in this these accounts of this particular game, what I found was a particularly kind of modern project of trying to create a story around a piece of national culture, which was sort of being deployed in the name or in the service of empire originally, and then the nation state, which sort of distinguishes it quite dramatically, I think, and this is the basic argument, quite dramatically from, you know, this idea of a traditional game that evolves and develops into a modern game.
You've already mentioned the 40s and the early 50s, and chapter 2 deals with sport and the colonial encounter in these periods. In particular, you're interested in the national renewal project under the Vichy regime and how that project was exported across the French Empire in that period. Can you say something about that project, first of all, and then what specific form did it take in Indochina and in Laos?
Yeah, well, so this is a sort of fascinating product, I suppose, of the collaborationist Vichy regime in France under Marshal Bétain. There was a ultra-conservative sort of movement for national renewal, known as the National Revolution. And one aspect of this, there were many aspects to it, but one aspect of it was sort of rebuilding the French body, if you like, of the French man in particular, after the humiliations of defeat by Germany and, you know, previous earlier defeats. And so there was quite a dense and detailed national sort of bureaucracy that was set up to promote sport and youth activities. It wasn't stated in the title or anything, but overwhelmingly this was for men. There were female versions, but these were very different activities. They set up these particular sport and youth schools according to ideology called Hébertism, which is sort of named after a particular physical trainer from that period. And the idea being that, you know, France's honour and France's strength would be regained through the male body in particular, by rebuilding the male body. Now, this was more or less exported to the colonies. There's a terrific book that I quote in that chapter, by Eric Jennings on Vichy in the Tropics, which talks about how it was exported to a number of different parts of the French Empire. And one of the places he looks at is Indochina. There's another book, an important book on that process as well. So I won't go into that in great detail, but those institutions, national institutions in France, are basically replicated in Indochina, particularly in the main centres of Hanoi and Saigon, but also in Pantiat in southern Vietnam, southern Annam, as it was. And that's where a physical education and youth school was established to do the same kind of training, to train physical education instructors and to promote some of these sporting events, which were more or less lifted from the French context, so they kind of created an Indo-Chinese version of the Tour de France, the Tour de Indochine, a football competition, the Bataan Cup between the five different territories of Indochina, and many other events and so forth. Now, Laos was a small part of this. I mean, Laos was a relatively remote, the smallest of the five territories and relatively remote. But all of these ideas sort of flowed through in one way or another. I mean, they were adapted. Some things were enhanced. Some things were dropped. But to the extent that the Lao National Renovation, which I'll come back to in a moment, was largely realized through the body, and again, once again, through the male body. Now, this Lao National Renovation, other scholars have written about this. It's a very important time in the development of sort of proto-nationalism in Laos, sort of a colonial form, a colonial sanctioned form of nationalism. And this was basically aimed at buttressing the Lao against the sort of irredentist forays of the Greater Thai Project through that time under Phit Bun Song Krang. And that's well known in the literature. What was interesting to research here was just the extent to which the Lao body was drawn into these projects. And it, once again, mostly the Lao male body, although the female body was also a vessel, if you like, through which this was this project was carried out. But women were represented very differently, and only played certain types of sports, basketball or tennis, for example. Whereas men were subject to many of these same institutions which were set up in Indochina and in France, you know, physical education training, schools, various sports societies and sports clubs and that kind of thing. And this was a highly militarized movement, which would be very important in the years to come, in the sense that, you know, there's lots of marching involved. There was sort of a highly regimented day or program within these, you know, youth and physical education schools. They incorporated certain local dimensions to it, such as meditation and so on. And in some ways, these sort of intersected very, very well with existing notions of discipline from sort of Buddhist heritage among young men in particular. So these young men were kind of receiving similar messages through traditional Lao experiences of ordaining and spending time in temples and then joining these sport and youth and physical education schools for short periods in order to go off and teach these subjects at school. I suppose just to say one more thing about that, the important thing was it goes back to this idea that it was a renovation project for this petite patrie, as it was sort of known, a small country of Laos, in order to sort of buttress Laos as a sort of national, proto-national entity, and that this could be carried out through the body. So it made the body a very meaningful part of that process.
You've already mentioned some of the militaristic aspects of the training, and in the following chapter, opposite from page 87, the first figure in the chapter shows images of young men marching with their arms raised in what is unmistakably a Nazi-style salute. Now, seeing those images, my immediate response was this must have been a performance, a parade in the Vichy period. And then when I looked below and saw it's in the 1950s, I was taken aback. Can you talk to how we see the persistence of militarism in the 1950s and specifically the intersection between militarism and sport during this period of Laotian autonomy, if not independence?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really important question because it shows just how important those Vichy programs were in introducing new forms of regimentation and practice, particularly for groups of young men. The Nazi salute that you refer to was embraced through the Vichy era, so through the Second World War period. Of course, it's instantly recognisable and, as you say, unmistakably, the Nazi salute. But it wasn't referred to as such. It was referred to as the Olympic salute. And this was the formal name for it through the 30s up until the Nazi Olympic Games of 1936, when it became problematic for fairly obvious reasons. Through these, you know, Vichy France and then Vichy Indochina and Vichy era Laos, the Olympic salute, which looks remarkably like the Nazi salute, was retained throughout this period as an expression of Olympic values formally through the Vichy era. And it is striking, as you say. I think what's even more striking is that it was retained after the Second World War, when you would have thought people would stop doing such a salute, even if it was called the Olympic salute. But indeed, this was used in the shield for the school that was set up through this period to carry on these sort of Vichy programs, a youth and physical education school. It was used on that the Lao Youth Shield. So there was no trying to sort of brush this under the carpet. It was really considered to be a very important part of this sort of nascent sort of national spirit, reflecting these values around regimentation, order, the uprightness, the loyalty, the solidarity of the male body. And the pictures you describe, which I'm looking at right now, are really striking, particularly because there's large groups of people marching together, and all of those images, all of those themes really come through in that image. More broadly on this chapter, I mean, it really is around that transition from what was a colonial set of practices to something more ambiguous through this period, this sort of period of the late 1940s and the early 1950s, through which Laos gained its independence sort of in a number of stages, sort of episodically, if you like. And what's really important here is that what was had previously been very clearly imperial and colonial practices, which had identified some kind of benefit in promoting a form of Lao patriotism, now became much more closely associated with the nation of Laos itself. And what that means is very important, because it means that as Laos was coming of age, as they like to say, through that period, it was coming of age as this highly kind of militarized and masculine state. And this cultural dimension of militarization that I try and explore in this chapter, particularly through the photographs, actually, which I was very fortunate to get in quite large number from the French military media archives in Paris. They have a tremendous collection, and they really do kind of open up a whole new way of doing the history of this period sort of through visual culture.
I agree that the text and images work very well together, and the combination of both your analysis and your talking through of the historical story alongside those images really conveys very powerfully to the reader the message that you're delivering about the relationship between militarism and sport in that chapter. We should keep moving on, and I'd like to turn to chapters 4 and 5, and there we go into the period of really modern theatrics with the emergence of new forms of state power and expressions of state power as told in chapter 4 through the establishment of national games and the running of national games in 1961 and 1964. Can you say something about those games, and maybe something also about the person who founded them and the reasons they had for establishing them?
Yeah, well, it flows on very nicely from the chapter we've just been discussing, because the third chapter on this period immediately after the Second World War goes into some detail in discussing this, and a lot of the pictures that we've discussed already were taken from this National School of Sport and Physical Education, which was actually housed in the Tatluang, the national symbol. And that very important national monument. Now, the director of that particular school was the person you refer to, Lieutenant, later Colonel, later General Pumi Norsewan, who was the dominant right-wing military figure through the early 1960s in Laos. Now, he started out, well, he didn't start out, but one of his earlier roles was as director of this school that was housed at Tat Luang in the early 1950s. And then by the end of the decade, he had risen through the ranks, and he was the deputy prime minister. He was the minister of defense. He was the most powerful, most ruthless military figure in the country. Now, he was also a boxer in a, you know, as a youth, and seems to have had a particular interest in sports and the formative dimensions of sport and how that could be used in these sort of military ways, in military training and various other things. And as well as being the defense minister in this period, in the early 1960s, he was also the minister for sport and youth. And in that capacity, he established these national games in 1961. Now, these games, in many ways, to sort of foreshadow what I'll speak about next, were based in some ways on the Southeast Asia Peninsula Games, which were founded in 1959 in Thailand, and we'll come back to those in a moment and Laos's place in them, I'm sure. But another thing to note about Pumi Norsewan, as a general, the most powerful military figure in the country, a right-wing figure who enjoyed a great deal of patronage from the US military, was also related through marriage to the dictator of Thailand, Field Marshal Sarit Thanirat. So, you know, there are all these sort of connections pointing towards, you know, militarism, right wing, US patronage, corruption, and so on. And sort of put all these things together and you get a picture of Pumi Norsewan, sort of known to be a very ruthless sort of military figure through that period. Now, in 1961, he established these national games. And the irony of these national games, or the central irony of them in a sense, was that they aimed to produce an image of national unity at a time when Laos was absolutely riven with disunity. This was the Cold War. Pumi was a right-wing general enjoying the support of the US military. He enjoyed his position by virtue of that support. The US had been involved in various matters in the late 1950s, which had brought the right to power in Vientiane. And as a result of this, you could probably find no person less suited in the country to building a unified national state. However, despite that disunity and despite his role in creating it, he founded this these national games as a means of promoting national unity, and the second main theme of the games was national progress. Now, this sort of goes back to various images around sport and around the body and the way that it's represented through sporting events and in images, and these were the central two themes. Now, what was interesting about that, or what I try and develop in this chapter, is that in a sense there was kind of two things going on at the same time. In one sense, this event, which was the largest, you know, sporting event that had been held in Laos up until this point, you know, bringing together all of the different provinces around the country, including provinces which were actually ruled at that time by the left, by the Vitet Lao. In doing this, one aspect of it, one of the benefits, I suppose, for Pumi was this idea of, you know, a big spectacle to reinforce, you know, his state power. He was a deputy prime minister, but the most influential figure in the government. As a way of kind of asserting and consolidating and reinforcing state power by representing, by giving physical form, if you like, to these themes of national unity and progress. But what also struck me as I was reading these accounts was just how sort of similar it was to a much older form of sort of performative power that we're very familiar with in Southeast Asian studies and history, in the form of the sort of theist state that's, you know, famously discussed by Clifford Geertz. And I won't go in too deeply into the details here, but what I sort of develop in the chapter is that this isn't simply a way of reinforcing state power, you know, through legitimacy and so on, but also a means of displaying his status as the most sort of powerful and, as I argue, sort of towards the end of the chapter, the most modern figure, at least in his self-perception in Lao politics.
Maybe a word or two about what happened to him and to the games before we go on to the final period.
Well, and the other chapter also. So the first games, you know, doing Lao history, you're often limited by sources. I didn't have a particularly good account of the first games. In fact, I had no account of the first games. In Vientiane, I had a very nice account from newspaper articles of the second games in Savannakhet, which were very important because that was Phumin Aswan's hometown, and they were the second games were held there. Immediately after that, virtually, you know, within months, he was deposed. First there was an attempted coup, which attempted to depose him from power, and after that, he was deposed and went into exile in Thailand. And I sort of make the point, and I hope it sort of resonates in the book, I make the point that in the sense that the games were a vehicle for which Phumi could display his status, in that sense the games collapsed in the years following his exile and were no longer conducted. The other chapter you asked about was the chapter that follows, which is chapter 5 on the Southeast Asia Peninsula Games and the Games of the New Emerging Forces. And without going into great detail there, I'm really looking at the way that Lao teams participated in regional sport as a means of asserting different ideas of what the Lao nation were at that time. And these two ideas were basically this royalist version of Laos, which was under the military through that earlier period that I've already discussed, and later under a civilian royalist government, and then the other side in the Lao civil war, the Pathet Lao, the communist side, and how they actually joined a regional event for the first time in 1966, the Games of the New Emerging Forces of Asia, which were held in Phnom Penh. And through that chapter, I sort of I dissect, if you like, how participating in these different events situated different iterations of the Lao nation within the region.
You've mentioned sources, so I can't help but ask you briefly, could you say something about the archival, ethnographic and other sources you used? And you mentioned difficulties in obtaining materials when researching Laos, so I'm sure listeners would be interested in this.
Yeah, look, it's a really important question around just how we do historical research of some of this period, at least. I mean, the colonial period is reasonably well taken care of in the colonial archives. But there's quite a large gap from the end of the colonial period and the last few years of the colonial period are pretty mixed in terms of sources there. And up until the socialist period. The socialist period from 1975 comes with different challenges, but the biggest challenge is that period sort of from the late 40s through to 1975, because when the Lao People's Revolutionary Party took power in 1975, they more or less closed off that chapter archivally as well as politically and so on. So the book draws on a pretty wide range of sources. You know, rather than dwelling on this as a problem, I sort of embraced it as an opportunity, I suppose. Well, I tried to. So I've drawn on, as you sort of mentioned before, a number of really rich images that I was able to locate, pretty traditional sources like newspapers and so on, pamphlets and these sorts of things where possible, the accounts of travel writing and ethnography that I mentioned before in that first chapter, and so on. For the socialist period after 1975, which we're probably going to move on to momentarily, I was very fortunate to be able to access archives there. They come with their own problems. Socialist archives are not necessarily the most reliable in a sort of traditional sense source, but I tried to use them in a sort of to read them against themselves, if you like, as different forms of rhetoric and statements of rule. And yeah, I mean, I think it did present opportunities in this way, using a very wide range sources, in mostly in Lao and French.
Well, you've already moved us into the remaining period with a couple of references to 75 and the socialist period. Can you briefly explain these remaining chapters? How do you address this period in comparison to earlier periods? So how does the notion of socialist modernity and revolutionary physical culture compare to the practices in the preceding periods you've already discussed?
I mean, it's a two-part answer in some ways. In many ways, the ideas that were developed through the 1940s, in particular, 40s and 50s and 60s, continue to be discussed in very similar language. The body remains a very important sort of metaphor for the development of a national body politic. And similar forms of language, similar ideas around associating individual strength, the need for physical training, and so on, with national development, in this case, in a sort of socialist guise. But then there are a number of important departures, which I suppose are more important in some ways. I think the first main difference is that in some ways, and I try and develop this in both chapters 6 and 7, I suppose, in some ways, physicality becomes a defining metaphor of the regime itself. So, you know, we're talking earlier about the importance of language. In a sense, the language of physicality works its way into the way that the regime sees itself, the way the regime promotes its task of building socialism for a start, and building new socialist people. So we see this kind of physical language almost, you know, ubiquitously throughout these sources. And that's sort of what I mean by turning sources upside down and reading them in this different way. And then there are some more practical differences as well. And I suppose this moves on to more specifically chapter 7, where I look at rather than mass sport. So chapter 6 relates to those ideas of how language is imbued with these ideas of physicality and these different forms of physical culture brought to bear. Chapter 7 looks more specifically at spectator sport and what we might call elite level sport, such as it could be called that. And in particular, the way that sporting events were used as a way to promote the values of the socialist regime, so around sort of, you know, revolutionary spirit and that kind of thing, but also some more specific areas such as equality equality between the sexes. So you start to see greater attention, more explicit attention being paid to women in sport, which is an important distinction given this earlier tendency to focus almost exclusively on men. And then I suppose the great moment in Lao sport also occurs through this period. One of the other major themes through this period is the way that these sporting events can draw Laos into and express membership of the socialist world. And of course, the great event in terms of sport in the socialist world occurred exactly at this time, at the 1980 Moscow Olympic Games, and this was the first time that Laos joined the Olympic movement under a great deal of advice and support from the Soviets. And they went to the Moscow Games, sent a huge team. I mean, almost half of the total number of athletes to have represented Laos at the Olympic Games since then went to those games, around a team of around 18 or 20 people, so a very large team. Of course, they weren't expected to win or do very well. The important thing here was being a member of that socialist world and drawing on some of those sort of socialist values, I suppose, around, you know, notions of democracy, such as they were under Marxist-Leninism, around ideas of ethnic solidarity and so on.
Okay, so you talk about how the team wasn't expected to win. It was participation and solidarity and other things that counted for success. This point really ties in with a point that you make right at the end of the book in the final chapter, which is concentrated on the Southeast Asian Games that Laos hosts in 2009, where you talk about the malleability of what counts as success. And to quote, you said that because of this malleability, it would be a mistake to view the history of Laos sport and physical culture through the prism of failure. Can you expand on that point a bit and maybe tie it back in very briefly with the 2009 games that you discuss in the final chapter before we close?
Perhaps I'll start with the 2009 games because, in a sense, that's the sort of the apogee of the Lao story or Lao history of sport, of participation in international sport in particular at these games in 2009. This is the first major sporting event that Laos could host. Thousands of athletes, the 11 countries of ASEAN plus East Timor participating. You know, a major, major undertaking. Now, this had to be funded through Chinese aid for the stadium and various other aspects of it. And there was a great deal of criticism around this. But in the end, you know, the athletes came through after a great deal of coaching and provision of equipment and also the way in which the games are set up to enable the host team to do well. And they won, you know, unexpectedly, they won 33 gold medals. You know, this is unheard of. I think previously their best had been five, and that was in the previous SEA Games when they were already in training for their own SEA Games. So this was really quite extraordinary. And demonstrated, if you like, the only moment in which Lao history has sort of succeeded according to these, you know, most basic criteria for success in sport in terms of, you know, medals and so on. So what I mean by malleability, in a sense, is that this is utterly the exception to the rule. It's a very interesting case study. The games themselves were a huge event in Laos and really worthy of greater attention, and I hope to come back to them in further work. But you know, in every other event, in every other, whether it's in Moscow in 1980, whether it was in the SEA Games for the Southeast Asia Peninsula Games in the 1960s, whatever you're talking about, in these kind of conventional measures of success, according to those, Laos is just not succeeding. So I suppose malleability comes back to, well, how do you define success in a sense? Or what is the meaning, what is the underlying meaning and significance of sport? And I suppose the answer to that, you know, to summarise the all of the preceding chapters, is that it can be sort of sport and the way in which you talk about sport, the way in which you participate, military training, physical education, all of these different sorts of techniques of the body, ways of developing the body, can be applied in all sorts of ways to the development and the modernity and the emergence, I suppose, of the nation. Now, you saw this in the sort of colonial iteration of Laos, in the royalist iteration of Laos that we discussed, and in the socialist iteration of Laos. And most recently, as demonstrated by the exception to the rule, the SEA Games, in a sort of post-socialist, developmentalist Laos. I mean, whoever's in charge at a particular time, whichever regime is overseeing sport, is talking about sport, is developing sport through that period and physical culture more broadly, will find some very, very important and sort of core value in it that is tied to the development of the nation state. And I suppose the one thing to kind of finish off on that is the flip side of that, which I developed throughout the book, but more explicitly in the conclusion, is that naturally this has a flip side to it, if you like, in a country that has almost always been an authoritarian state of some kind. Not always, I shouldn't generalize too much. Much of the royalist period was not authoritarian. but over the course of its history, most of that time, Laos has been under authoritarian, colonial, now socialist rule. These ideas around the malleability of sport, that demonstrate the malleability of sport and physical culture, have often operated to reinforce state power. And I suppose that's a sort of a sobering reflection, if you like, on what the flip side of success defined in these ways might be.
It's great to have a guest who ties everything together so neatly. Thank you very much for doing that, Simon. I'd like to turn and ask you a final question, which is, what are you working on now? What can you look forward to next?
Well, I'm working on two main things, but I suppose, and they both come out of a similar area, you know, the different ideas that are developed in this book. But the main one that's keeping me busy at the moment is the history of the Southeast Asian Games. So this was originally founded as the Southeast Asia Peninsula Games, and I look at that event and Laos's involvement in it in Chapter 5, as we were discussing earlier in this book. So I'm sort of expanding my focus on Laos to sort of a regional level of analysis to look at the way in which sport has sort of been used, different meanings around sport and this specific event. So more specific in this case on a particular event rather than sport and physical culture in general, but how this event, which has been conducted now for nearly 60 years, every second year in different parts of Southeast Asia, has operated as a way of, I suppose, shaping regional relations in the region and presenting and producing certain ideas of the region. Of course, this is a period that begins with decolonization and the Cold War, an incredibly dynamic but also sort of tumultuous period. Coming right up until now, where the Cold War is long gone and the new set of challenges presents itself to the region. Interesting thing about this event is it began before this ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and has developed in some ways parallel and intersecting ways with it. So that's one, that's the main project at the moment. And the other main area that I'm continue to work on is history of, I suppose, political culture in Laos, sort of broadly defined. So rather than focusing particularly on the body and the ways we can read some of these aspects of political culture through the body, focusing on political culture more broadly, particularly through language. That's one project that's underway, but a broader project for which is sort of in very early stages will, I think, eventually take me to some kind of history of the revolution in Laos.
Plenty going on, and I'm sure that many listeners will be interested, especially having read your book, if they haven't done so already, to be following what it is that you'll be doing in the next few years. So, Simon Creek, thanks again for speaking with me today about embodied nations, sport, masculinity, and the making of modern Laos.
Thanks, Nick.
And thanks to everyone for listening. I do hope you'll join me again for another meeting with an author on new books in Southeast Asian Studies. And if you haven't done so already, check out the archive of podcasts on the New Books Network site. Hey,